So sometimes when I'm talking to paleontologists, they'll express this kind of deep disquiet about species concepts. They don't really know what to do about it, but they'll be aware that when we say species, we mean a bunch of different things, and they'll kind of... they don't really know whether that's a problem or not, right? But they'll be a bit upset about it, right? This is just anecdotal. It's kind of hard to find paleontologists actually saying this stuff in print. I don't think it's a problem. So I'm going to argue, make a claim of a paleontological practice, and I'm going to say that paleontological investigation is indifferent to species concepts. What I mean by that is that it's not going to matter which species concept you're using when you're doing paleontology, or at least the paleontology I'm going to talk about. Now I'm going to use this claim about paleontological practice to ground a further claim about the species debate. And this is a claim about whether or not we should be realists about the species category. So there's this debate about whether or not, given pluralism about species concepts, whether or not we should believe that there's this category called species. I'm going to make an argument to say, due to the indifference that we see in paleobiology, that gives us reason to think that there is a species category. We should be realists about that kind. And this actually also grounds an even broader claim in what I'm going to dare to call naturalized metaphysics, or maybe naturalized epistemology, which is that there are some grounds for being a realist about a disunified category. If any of you know about the philosophy of mind, this is sometimes called wildly disjunctive kinds, things like that. Right? So this is a paper with a lot, there's lots of levels going on at the same time. So it's going to be a very full 40 minutes, and we'll just see how we go. All right. Here's how it's going to go. I'm going to start by giving us an overview of conceptual pluralism. So this is going to be a primer. It's not going to use very worked out examples. It's supposed to get you on board if you're not familiar with the debate. I'm then going to give us a case study, which I'm going to base my claims about paleobiological practice on. This is going to be about Triceratops. I'm then going to make my indifference claim, so that's where I'll argue, hey, if you're a paleontologist, don't worry about the species concepts. Just ignore it. It's fine. And then I'm going to take us from indifference to realism. So let's go. What is a conceptual pluralist? Well, a conceptual pluralist believes something about a category. What's a category? Well, you might think about a category as being maybe a potential kind. So maybe unicorn is a category, or book, or fossil, as we heard earlier. Or in this case, maybe species is a category, right? So a conceptual pluralist thinks something about a category. What do they think? Well, they think there are at least two concepts which relate to that category. What do I mean by concepts? Well, here I'm thinking about concepts as a way of deciding category membership. So a concept tells you how to carve up the world, right? So, let's be boring. There's a category called bachelor, right? And there's a concept which says to be a bachelor, you have to be an unmarried man. The concept tells us who gets to be a bachelor and who doesn't, right? So if you're a conceptual pluralist, you think that for some category, there are at least two ways of deciding membership of that category, which meets these three conditions. They've got to be non-equivalent, which is to say, they carve up the world in different ways. They make different decisions about who gets to be in that category. They've got to be also ineliminable for some legitimate research program, which is to say, there's some research program which is legitimate, it's generating knowledge or something, it's not astrology, and that research program needs that concept, is one way of putting it. And so, if you're a conceptual pluralist, you think for a category, there are at least two non-equivalent concepts which are ineliminable qua some legitimate research program, or programs. I should probably put a parenthesis around that, yes. So, notice that the sort of background idea here is that what's making the concepts valid is sort of derivative from them being used by these research programs, right? So there's this sort of naturalized metaphysics or naturalized epistemology going on in the background, which says, us philosophers, we don't get to decide what's legitimate or what's real or whatever. The scientists tell us that. So that's going to matter for what happens later on. Okay, for those of you who have done philosophy of biology, I'm sorry, but let's have a quick look at two kind of caricatured versions of some species concepts just to illustrate things. Here's a species concept. Let's call it the biological species concept. Here, what we do is we decide membership of a species based on whether or not you're in the same breeding population. So if I want to know whether I'm the same species as you guys, I need to ask a question about a population, right? Are we members of the same interbreeding population? Here's another one. It's called a phylogenetic species concept. Notice the blatant cheating at the end of the definition here. Here, two organisms are part of the same species, just in case they're part of the same species-level lineage. Right? So here I'm asking whether or not we're part of the same, perhaps, historical individual or something like that. So these are two different ways that I might go about carving up the membership of species. Okay. Well, let's think about whether or not they're non-equivalent. Well, it seems like they kind of straightforwardly are. Remember, to be non-equivalent, they just have to give different answers in some context as to whether or not things are the same species. Here's an easy one. Here's a rotifer. Rotifers, like most life, reproduce asexually, and so on the face of it, don't form breeding populations, right? Under at least a very straightforward, very simple-minded idea about what a breeding population is. And so it looks as if the biological species concept doesn't really have anything to tell us about rotifers. But they do form phylogenies, they do form ancestral lineages, and so it seems as if we can say something using the phylogenetic species concept. And so they give different answers in different cases. Are they eliminable for some research program? Well, if any of you have looked at the philosophy of mathematics before, trying to work out whether something is eliminable for some research program is really, really difficult, right? The question of whether or not mathematics is necessary for science is a very complicated, nightmarish area of philosophy. So I don't think we're going to do very well kind of trying to decide that. But what we can at least do is give cases where it looks as if some concepts are more useful for certain research programs, right? I'm going to do a non-species level example because it's very straightforward. Here are some even-toed ungulates. It seems like there are going to be some contexts in which I want to group these fellows together, and it seems as if in some of those contexts I want to exclude these guys, right? I want to exclude cetaceans, very different ecological roles, so on and so forth. And yet, if I'm tying myself to a phylogenetic conception of how taxa are delineated, then I'm going to have to include them, right? Because cetaceans are nestled within that ungulate clade, right? Cetaceans are more closely related to hippopotamuses than hippopotamuses are to giraffes, for instance. And so it looks like if I want to talk about just those guys, I'm going to have to use a concept which isn't the phylogenetic species concept, right? So it's more useful. So maybe the biological species concept will be more useful for that kind of consideration. Legitimate? What do we mean here? Well, I don't know. I'm not going to say anything too hard about that. But here's one thing you might say. You might think that there's a species concept which is necessary for Aristotelian biology. You might think that Aristotelian biology is no longer a good thing to be doing. And so I don't feel the need to take the Aristotelian species concept, whatever that might be, maybe something about, I'm not even going to bother trying to explain that. I don't need to worry about that concept in terms of taking it seriously or thinking it tells me something about the way the world is. Okay. Now, let's just pretend, let's just go with me on this, that we are conceptual pluralists about the species. We think that there's this category species, and we think that there's a bunch of different ways of carving up what counts in what species. Seems like there's a tension between that and being a realist about the species category, right? So if you're someone like Kitcher, at least in the 80s, you have a view that looks a bit like this. You've got this category species, and you're a realist about that category. You think it exists and stuff. You say true things about it, perhaps. But it's kind of pegged out by this multitude, this plurality of different concepts which carve the world up in different ways. An immediate tension you might feel is to say something like, well, hang on, the species category just doesn't look unified, right? It seems like we should look at it perhaps in this way. And moreover, if we think that science tells us about the way the world is, science is where we should draw our ontology, this picture, in fact, looks better. It's more like what the scientists are saying. Which I take it is roughly Mark Hrushevsky's argument for anti-realism about the species category. So as he says, contemporary biological theory gives us ample evidence, heaps of evidence, that the tree of life is segmented into different types of species taxa. So there's no single unitary species category. There's no thing we should be realist about. Rather, there's this heterogeneous collection of base taxa. So, in other words, instead of having... Whoa, that's not right. Whoa, one species category, we're going to have a whole bunch of different ones, right, which track these concepts. I'm going to disagree with this view. But first... Oh, yes. So, a conceptual pluralist believes that you've got a bunch of different concepts which pertain to some category or kind, as we've seen. Notice that part of the justification of this is this kind of naturalized metaphysics or naturalized epistemology. You get this vindication from being necessary for some research program. And there's this tension that we've seen between conceptual pluralism and category realism. If you've got a disunified category, what grounds could you have for being a realist about that category? Okay, let's talk about Triceratops for a while. So Triceratops is probably the most well-known dinosaur, one of the most, you know, it's the horns and the frill, that one. Yeah, I think Sarah from The Land Before Time. Yeah, what? All right, anyway. They're a kind of ceratopsid. They're a pretty diverse and pretty successful dinosaur clade. So here's me in Dinosaur Provincial Park with the centrosaur horn. You can go out there, it's just an area of badlands in Alberta, and they'll take you out and there'll be sort of these, you know, assemblages of sort of 30 or 40 individuals who are being sort of taken out by a flood, right? So there are herd animals, a whole lot of them, and they've got a bunch of pretty specific features, right? That is, the beak is a distinctive feature, and they've got what's called the squamosal, which is this crest that comes out, and of course the horns, right? So they're kind of like rhinoceroses that live in herds. That's what I'm thinking about them. Okay. What we're specifically interested in are these two, Torosaurus and Triceratops. Now, these are the two genus of Ceratopsid which appear to be present at the KPG boundary. So these guys made it right to the end of sort of the Mesozoic period. They're found pretty commonly in North America, particularly in the Hell's Creek formation. What we're kind of interested in here is how we go about classifying Torosaurus and Triceratops. On one view, which was the view that was originally had when these guys were discovered in the late 19th century, is these are different genus there, different critters. By another view, these are actually the same species. Roughly, this Torosaurus is Triceratops' mother, hence the title. Right? Torosaurs, it turns out, are just mature Triceratops. One thing that's going to be important for sort of getting how this is supposed to work is to look at their skulls. So obviously that's a torosaur, that's a triceratops. First notice that the torosaur's got kind of a more extended, let's call it beak, right? It's also got a wider squamosal, and it's got these big holes in it, and moreover its horn is kind of straighter. Right? But otherwise, you know, sort of similar. The argument that we're going to look at roughly works like this. You get a developmental trajectory which shows how Triceratops' skull changes through time. You then just let it keep running, and it turns into a torosaur. That's the basic argument. And so the background thought of this argument is based on Triceratops' development. It turns out that Triceratops' skulls develop kind of in really interesting ways over their life cycle. So if we're going from the top left down to the bottom right, this is sort of a baby Triceratops, it's very cute, all the way to an adult Triceratops. Right? Notice these big changes. One thing that's just kind of I find really cool is the sort of eye horn goes from pointing backwards to pointing forwards, which is kind of weird. You also find that they lose these kind of fancy little thing, these little horns around their frills, and they also the squamosal elongates out, right? And so there was a bit of work done in around 2006 that sort of gave you this developmental sequence and quantified it in various ways for the Triceratops. Then in 2010, Scaler and Horner argue that on that basis largely, it turns out that Torosaurus is just Triceratops. Right. So this, of course, was reported in the media that Triceratops doesn't exist, which is kind of annoying. So here's their evidence. First off, as I've been emphasizing, if we extrapolate the developmental trajectory we see in Triceratops, we get Torosaur forms. Here's an example. So on the y-axis, we've got the length of your frill versus the width of your frill. And on the x-axis, we've just got the length of your frill. Here we've got little baby triceratopses and teenage triceratopses and sub-adult triceratops. I don't know what a sub-adult, maybe a graduate student triceratops. and sort of mature Triceratopses. And the thought is, look, here are all the torosaurs, the torosauruses are out here, and the claim is, look, if we just, we can just draw a line through that and we're going to capture the torosaurs. Doesn't look very convincing, does it? But we'll just move on from that. Some other evidence they have is they do some osteohistological studies. So it turns out that when you're young, you've got different looking cells to when you're old, and those differences are fossilized, and so we can access them. And so they claim that Triceratops specimens have younger tissue than Torosaurus specimens. They also point out that there don't seem to be any baby torosaurs, which is weird. There also aren't very many torosaurs, which is interesting. You find, you know, bucket loads of Triceratops, but torosaurs are a lot rarer. And finally, these things overlap in strata. Now, I've just given you the positive case. If you want, in question time, we can talk about the negative case, right? One example of, maybe I'll give you a quick hint. Remember those holes in the torosaur crest? It turns out that ceratopsids that have holes in their crests have them from when they're babies. They don't have cases of them developing the holes later on. Right? So there's one of the arguments that's been given against this view. In fact, it was given by these guys, Longrich and Field, and they have a quote which brings out exactly what I want to emphasize about this case. Before one can use variation to classify species, so before you can look at differences in morphology or whatever, in order to say this is a species or this, you know, these are the same species, different species, you've got to understand the nature of the variation. So, do the differences between the two fossils represent variation between different species? So in other words, is the best explanation of these differences that they've had separate evolutionary histories? Or do they reflect variation within a single species, right? Which can result from a bunch of stuff, right? Sexual dimorphism, for instance, changes in morphology over the course of development. So here's the point. When they're delineating these species, they're arguing about the following thing. What's the best explanation of the differences and similarities between these different fossils? Right? These different, what's the word we're using instead of fossil? Specimen, thank you, much better. Between these two specimens, right? On one kind of view, the best explanation is that they have separate evolutionary histories. On the other, they represent variation within the same phenotype. And so, what Scaler and Horner are trying to show with their evidence is that within taxa processes, in this case ontogenetic diversity, better explains the differences between Triceratops and Torosaurus than without taxa processes. In other words, them having different evolutionary histories. Here's another thing to notice. This isn't just a matter of kind of classifying things, right? It's not as if this is just an unimportant question about whether or not I want to put them in the same box or different boxes. This isn't merely paleo-natural history, right? This is paleontological science, right? Why? Well, here are some things that Scaler and Horner do once they've sort of made their case that Triceratops and Torosaurus are the same. First off, they use this as an inroads to understanding Triceratops' behavior and adaptation. So, for instance, they ask, well, why would you have such big differences between the way your mature adults look and the way that your little, your less mature critters look? Well, it might be that this is a sort of signaling of maturity, right? It might be playing something like a sort of silverback kind of role for your gorilla, something like that. So, you know, it gives them a basis for some fun speculation. But it also has some important upshots for general dinosaur diversity. For instance, there's this puzzle about North American dinosaurs, which is that there are just too many of them, right, in terms of species. There's just way more diversity in these giant herbivorous dinosaurs in the Cretaceous in North America than you would expect given, you know, now or given sort of the last 50 million years or something. And it looks like this sort of bit of work seems to suggest an explanation for this, which is that we've underestimated ontogenetic diversity in dinosaurs. It might be we're running around classifying things as different species when actually they're just different ages. Right? So that seems kind of important. Also, this gives us a bit of information about the nature of the KPG extinction. I'm really embarrassed that I'm the one tonight who's ended up talking about the dinosaur extinction, because I'm really pleased that no one else talked about it, because we talk about it too much, but I'll briefly mention it. So, we all know that a great big rock hit the Earth 65 million years ago. What we're not sure about is what role that played in causing the extinction event. By one view, the dinosaurs were kicking ass and being happy and running about, and then suddenly this big rock came and knocked them out. By another view, they were already kind of getting a bit crap and already kind of going down the plug hole, and then this thing came along and just sort of was a sort of coup de grace or something. Actually, folding Torosaurus into Triceratops makes a difference for how much we think this meteor, what role the meteor played, right? Because we've gone from two distinct Ceratopsid genera to just one genera, right? And moreover, if we link that to the point before it, this suggests actually that we've overestimated, systematically overestimated, dinosaur diversity. So this isn't just a matter of classifying samples, it also has important upshots for, you know, explanations. Okay, so what have I said? At least sometimes, at least this case what I've told you about, when you're a paleobiologist delineating species, you do this by making an abduction, effectively. You say, what best explains the variation between my samples? Is it separate evolutionary histories, or is it various types of within-lineage variation? So, variation in life stage, sexual dimorphism. So, this is mistaking babies for different species. This is mistaking males and females for different species. This is mistaking sick people for different species. So this has been suggested for, this has been very badly suggested for Homo floresiensis, but I think that as opposed to being a different species of hominid, it's actually got some kind of, you know, disability of some kind, which is rubbish. And so by the way, my credence in the claim that sort of whether Torosaurus and Triceratops are the same species or not is about 0.5. I have no idea whether, you know, I don't know what way to go on there. And also stratal location, right? And also notice that taxonomic decisions in paleobiology matter for reconstructing the ecology, social organization, behavior of populations, and also for identifying and explaining these large-scale macroevolutionary patterns. All right, so that's what I've got to say about Triceratopses. Let's look what result that has for the relationship between paleobiological investigation and species concepts. So here's a notion of indifference. I'm going to say, some research program is indifferent to a set of concepts pertaining to a category just when the various precipitations those concepts give us, the various ways that the concepts divide up the world, just makes no difference to that research program. So I'm going to argue that's the case for paleobiological delineation of species. And I'm going to make two points about this. First, I'm going to say that the criteria which paleobiologists use is indifferent to species concepts. Which is to say, the criteria that they use is going to matter no matter which species concept you apply. And then I'm going to argue that the research program that paleobiologists are interested in is also indifferent to these different species concepts. Okay, so the criteria claim. Here's the thought. Look, the criteria that paleobiologists use, the one that I've just given you, based on the Triceratops case, is what you would do no matter what species concept you cared about. Now, what I'm not going to do is go through any plausible species concept, because that would be very boring. What I'm going to do is just give us an example from the two species concepts we met earlier, and then draw a sweeping induction, which I'm sure you'll all be very convinced by. So let's imagine we've got a single fossil sample, we've got F, and we've got a single well-established species S, which F might belong to, right? So assuming that S is the only plausible known species, it's S or nothing, we've got two possible hypotheses, right? Either F is a member of S, or F is its own thing. So what does that mean if we put it in terms of different species concepts? Well, we might put it in terms of the phylogenetic species concept. We might say, well, F is a member of S, which means it's part of that historical lineage. Or it's not part of that historical lineage. Well, if you're a paleobiologist, how do you go about finding out whether or not something's part of an historical lineage or not? What kind of things do you need to know? Well, you want to know about variation within that historical lineage. You want to know what differences should I expect in phenotype across ontogeny? What differences should I expect in phenotype across between males and females? And so on and so forth. In other words, exactly the stuff that we saw them doing in the Triceratops case. Right? So if you care about the phylogenetic species concept, seems like the paleobiological criteria, the sort of abductive method, is spot on. Okay, what about the biological species concept? Now here you want to determine whether or not the species are part of the same breeding population. I've really been looking forward to this part of the talk. Now, you might think on the face of it, it's quite hard to identify breeding populations among extinct animals. Here's one way you can do it. So, there is one case, which was published a few years ago, of animals... The paper this was published in was called Caught in the Act, which was kind of inevitable, I think. But yeah, so they found a bunch of mating turtles. I think they're something like 20 million years old or so. So there's about sort of, I think it's about 15 pairs or so. I guess they were having an orgy and then the rock slide and some mud came down or something and they were sort of preserved in flagrante or something. Anyway, that was indulgent. I take it, we can't do that. We can only do that in that case, right? And, you know, they may have been kinky turtles. They may not have actually been part of a breeding population. So, anyway. So here the idea is I'm saying that F is part of breeding population S, or it's not part of that breeding population. How do I tell the difference? Well, I want to know about the properties of that breeding population. What variation and phenotype should I expect across that breeding population? What differences should I expect between the males and the females? Again, just the same questions. It seems like using this criteria, I mean, the paleobiological criteria is what I'm going to use, whether I'm using the phylogenetic species concept or whether I'm using the biological species concept. In other words, it's indifferent to it. So there's the argument for indifference. Now, you might say, okay, Adrian, this looks indifferent, but it's kind of boring indifference. It's circumstantial. The only reason that paleobiologists are using this criteria is because they're in such a crap epistemic situation. Right? They're just making do with what they've got. They're not able to go out and actually look at these critters, and so the best they can do is this kind of coarse-grained sort of delineation. So I'm going to say, no, it's not just circumstantial. I'm going to say it's also vindicatory. This indifference is not just generated by them only having coarse-grained access to the things they're interested in. It's also due to the kinds of questions that they're interested in, the sort of research program that they have. So I think there are some parallels here between what I'm about to say and what Derek said at the end of his talk. So here's the idea. A source of paleobiological indifference is the sorts of questions they ask. And I'm going to give a very schematic example of this. What sort of questions do paleobiologists ask? Well, here's one. Here's a incredibly inaccurate, but whatever. It's sort of look at a bunch of lineages, right? Here we've got the dinosaurs doing pretty well and they're getting really quickly cut off. Then we've got this radiation, glorious radiation from the mammals, presumably as soon as those nasty lizards have gotten out of the way. There's this question in paleobiology, which is, well, what explains macroevolutionary patterns? One version of this discussion is about species sorting. So species sorting asks the following sort of question. Here, a whole bunch of things went extinct and a whole bunch of other things didn't. Was that just random? Or are some species better at not going extinct than others? Right? So species sorting asks, at the macroevolutionary level, what sort of factors are influencing the survival or extinction of species? Right? So we can imagine a sort of continuum of answers to these. Again, I presume the answer will be somewhere in the middle. No idea. But you might think it's just random. You might think, look, who survives? And this is sort of a roughly Gouldian kind of view, I guess. Who survives and who doesn't is non-directional and non-systematic. It's just extinction is just a crapshoot. Or you might have something really strong to say. You might say, no, actually, there's selection at the level of species. It turns out that some species are better at surviving longer and better at creating daughter species, right? And you might even say it's systematic and deterministic and other sort of table-thumping things like that. Here's what matters to me about this. It looks like this is about species, right? On the face of it. But it doesn't look like answering this, it really matters whether I'm delineating species at that kind of fine-grained level that the biological species concept versus the phylogenetic species concept gives me. It doesn't look like the concepts make a difference, right? Here's one way of putting it. If I removed all that bad circumstance, and I gave paleobiologists complete access to the sort of taxonomic information, I don't think that would make much of a difference to how this debate goes, right? That's the sort of thought, right? So they do require species delineation. We do need to generate these sort of taxa in order to have this debate. But giving it at a finer grain doesn't seem to really make a difference to how that debate goes. So I've just argued that your paleobiological means of differentiating between species is indifferent to species concept, which is to say, doesn't matter which one you care about, you're going to use the same criteria. And I'm going to say that this indifference is vindicatory, which is to say it's not just circumstantial, it's due to the sorts of questions they're interested in. What I'm now going to do is use those as the first two premises of an argument, which will take me to realism about the species category. So what I've just done here is go, if you're a paleobiologist and you feel a bit worried about the plurality of species concepts, don't worry about it, it's fine. Right? Doesn't make a difference to your practice. Okay, so here are the first two premises of an argument. Here's a very cheap way of making an argument. What you want to do is get the premises you have and then make a conditional, which is if those premises, then the conclusion you want. So there we go. Let's call it the indifference principle. When some legitimate investigation is indifferent in regards to some category, in a vindicatory sense, then we should be realists about that category. I need another premise, of course, which is that paleobiological investigation is indeed legitimate, and then it looks like I get this conclusion. We ought to be realists about the species category, and here's the important bit. We're realists despite its disunity, right? So here we're agreeing that we're pluralists about the concepts. We don't think this is a unified category, but we're still realists. We still think that it's the right way to carve up the world to say there's this species category. Okay. Well, it seems like I should do a bit more work than just stipulate the indifference principle, right? I should probably say something in its defense. Well, I've got a positive thing to say, and I've got two negative things to say. The positive thing is this. Remember that the way that we got to conceptual pluralism about species was through this naturalized metaphysics or naturalized epistemology. We said, what makes something legitimate, some concept or some category? Well, it's the role that it plays in legitimate scientific investigation. It seems like I'm drawing on just the same thought with this indifference principle. I'm saying, hey, look, paleobiological investigation generates knowledge. It tells us things about the way the world is. And due to its indifference, then, it seems like that gives us reason to be realists about the species category. It seems like the same, it's sort of like the same sort of thinking that got us to conceptual pluralism should lead us to realism about these disunified categories. Or so is my thought. Here's the negative argument. The negative argument asks, well, what would you need to say in order to deny the indifference principle in a particular case? Right? So, what would happen if I've got a legitimate investigation that's indifferent to some category in a vindicatory sense, but we don't want to be realists about it? Well, here are two things you might say. You might say that the paleobiological inference is to a particular concept. You might say, oh, well, they actually do mean the biological species concept, or something like that. Or it's just to a fake category, right? You might say, look, you know, this is the more direct way of saying, no, this is maybe a fictional category or something like that. I don't think either of these work. They don't work because they involve denying other premises that I've already argued for, or at least asserted. If I said it was a fake category, that seems to clash with the fourth premise of the argument, right? The fourth premise of the argument said that paleobiological investigation is legitimate. And you might think that if an investigation is legitimate, then it probably isn't to a fake category, right? Here's a kind of bit of rhetoric from the written version of this, which I quite like. It seems as if Scalar and Horner, assuming that they're right, have generated some evidence, some knowledge, right? They've generated the knowledge that Torosaurus and Triceratops are the same critter. And it seems like knowledge is about something, and scientific knowledge, I claim, is about real things. If that's right, then it doesn't look like this is to a fake category. What if it's to a particular concept, right? Here the thought is, paleobiological investigation is targeted to a particular species concept after all, right? It's just they can't access it. Well, that clashes with another premise in the argument, which is the idea that paleobiological indifference is vindicatory, right? So, remember, to be vindicatory, the indifference is generated by the sorts of questions you ask. And saying that it would be to a particular concept if they just had enough information is to say that the indifference is circumstantial, right? So you just... Yeah, so it doesn't go through. And so assuming I'm right, that paleobiological indifference is vindicatory, then you can't go that route either. So I've argued that your means of differentiating between species when you're a paleobiologist is indifferent to species concepts. I've argued that indifference is vindicatory. You're doing that because of the sorts of questions you're interested in. I've asserted that paleobiological investigation is legitimate. I've then taken you from there to the idea that we should be realists about the species category, right? Even though it's disunified. part of the reason for that was a sort of parody of reasoning argument. The way we got to being a conceptual pluralist about species should also lead us to being a realist about this disunified category. And moreover, denying the indifference principle seems to involve denying either vindication or legitimacy. Let's consider some objections. How much time do I have?
You have about 10 minutes.
Before the end of the session?
Well, no, you have 20 minutes on the end of the session.
Oh, wonderful.
You can take
lots of time for questions. All right, I will not. Okay, here's something you might say. Adrian, look, you just mischaracterized paleobiological practice. There are some species concepts which do not suit paleobiological investigation. One way you might do this, for instance, is you might look at different areas of paleobiology, right? There's something weird about what I've done where I've pitched, like, giant charismatic vertebrate paleobiology, which lots of people think that's not really where the action is. The action is with invertebrate paleobiology, where we've got a lot more samples and a lot more stuff to play with. Fair enough. Another thing you might point to, rather ironically, is something like a phonetic species concept. Where with phonetic species concepts, or panclatism or something, there's this denial that history has anything to do with what we're doing when we're doing systematics, right? I'm just arranging the things so that they're similar, and so on and so forth. And it seems as if what I've seen about paleobiological investigation is right, they can't use a phonetic account, right? Here's a response. Good. Show me the money, right? There hasn't been enough work on the role that species concepts play in paleobiology. I've given you kind of an opening fire, right? And now say something back to me, right? So I do have things to say about phonetic species concepts. I think that when paleobiologists claim they're using these concepts, they're wrong. Response two might be something like this. Fine. If you want, I haven't established realism about species because I have to deny some legitimate species concepts as being part of this indifference. But it seems like the reasoning goes through for some taxa category realism, right? I'm still a realist about some disunified category. It's just maybe I can't call it species. I'm not going to be too upset about that. That's the first premise. Second premise, wait, what? You think that there are kind of kinds or categories which are real and true in some sense and the right way to carve up the world, but they're like wildly disjunctive? That's just weird, right? That's just a strange thing to say. I mean, you might appeal to philosophy of mind from the late 70s and point out that some relatively clever people have spent a lot of time arguing against this idea, right? And I agree, seems kind of weird. Here's some responses. In my kind of philosophical youth, I did spend a bit of time reading these sort of the stuff on disjunctive categories, disjunctive kinds, and one thing that's fair to say is that it's not a conclusive debate, right? I recall it hurting my head a lot. But if you want to go down that debate, and if you can give me really good reasons to say sort of a priori that, you know, there just couldn't be wildly disjunctive kinds, well, fair enough. That's a fun debate to have. Probably more importantly, it seems like you're kind of breaking the rules by going this way. Right? It seems as if the way that the species debate plays out is according to this idea where you don't really get to restrict things a priori. You don't really get to say, that's just weird, therefore I'm going to, you know, cut it out, right? What you have to do is look at scientific practice and draw it out of that. Now maybe there's something you could, you know, you could for instance go back and look at the history of science and go, hey look, when there's a disunified kind, that always ends up getting, like, done away with or something. That would be a really good way to respond to this paper. Here's the third objection. You can find biologists who are realists about species, the species category. You can even find some paleobiologists, but you have to kind of dig under rocks to find them. But pretty much no one is a realist about higher taxa, so far as I can tell. No one thinks that orders are real, or phyla are real, or genus are real. And so it looks like the case study I've given you, in fact, is at the genus rather than the species level, right? We're trying to decide whether these two separate genera, right, the Triceratops and the Torosaurus, is in fact the same species. And my claim, in fact, is that this kind of method of delineation is the way that paleobiologists work at the higher taxa levels as well. So have I just committed us to the existence of higher level taxa? Good question. First, I'm not too worried about the word species. I'm not too fussed if it turns out that the sorts of categories we end up being realists about aren't the ones we thought were on the table from the beginning. So don't worry about that. More importantly, and here's another show me the money, it seems that it doesn't follow from using the same method to identify higher taxa that they play the same role in paleobiological investigation. In other words, even if they're indifferent, you still have to show that it's indifferent in a vindicatory sense in order for the argument to go through, in order for me to be committed to realism. And so what we would need to do is go and have a look at the role that higher taxa play in paleobiological investigation in order to tell whether it's vindicatory or not. Now, I actually have a suspicion that this could work for phyla. I think that at least the sort of body plan stuff with phyla look like they're playing a really important role with at least some paleobiological investigation, and so I might end up having to be a realist about phyla. I'm not too fussed about that. Right, so these are three objections, and I've given us sort of three levels of claim. The first was a claim about naturalized metaphysics. This was the idea, roughly, that if you think that science is the thing which, you know, you should base your ontology on, or whatever, or truth on, or something, it looks like there are some grounds for realism about disunified categories. I've also made a claim in the species debate. I've said, at least looking at paleobiological practice, oh, and by the way, I'm very happy for it to also be true for other practices that they're also indifferent, right? I'd be astonished if it turned out that this was a special thing about paleobiology. But we should be indifference realists about the species category. And there's been this claim at the level of paleobiological practice, which has said, hey, if you're a paleontologist, don't get too caught up in species concepts. It turns out different species concepts don't make much of a difference or any difference to the way you should be going about doing your work. And with that message, I'll stop.